So glad that you are all able to be with us today. We are incredibly honored to have Dr. Kenneth Cook with us. He's going to be talking about the differences between diabetic, idiopathic, and secondary causes associated with gastroparesis. And we just continue to be so humbled by his willingness to do all these programs for AGMD. For those unfamiliar with AGMD or the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, we're a nonprofit organization that serves as an educational resource for GI motility disorders. We also function as an important information clearinghouse for members of the medical, scientific, and nutritional communities, and we provide a form of support for patients and their families. My name is Mary Angela DeGrazia DiTucci. I'm a longtime patient with multiple digestive motility disorders and other diseases. And with us here today, we also have Melissa Adams Van Houten, who will be assisting with our program. She's going to be doing the question and answer part. Melissa, can you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Melissa Adams Van Houten, and I was diagnosed with gastroparesis just about 8 years ago in February of 2014. I currently serve as the AGMD's Public Policy and Outreach Director, and I manage several online patient support and advocacy groups.
And I have to add, she's my right hand, left hand, and everything within the organization. So always appreciative of Melissa as well. Please be aware of the background that you're in, because if you are in a noisy environment, we'll be able to hear everything. So please make sure that you're in a quiet environment. And we ask that you hold off on your questions until the second part, which we have dedicated specifically for questions towards Dr. Cook. So for those not familiar with or unfamiliar with Dr. Cook, he is just the most wonderful doctor. He's currently professor of medicine, the section of gastroenterology and hepatology at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. He has a long career interest in understanding the pathophysiological mechanisms of nausea and gastroparesis. And he is part of the Clinical Gastroparesis Clinical Research Consortium, and has written 143 peer-reviewed publications, 43 chapters, and 2 books, and maybe a 3rd book coming up very soon. Dr. Cook, thank you as always for being with us. Yeah. And today's topic is one of great interest. People have so many questions concerning the differences between diabetic, idiopathic, and secondary causes, and we're anxious to learn from you, our master teacher, about all these differences.
All right. Well, thank you again, Mary Angela, for inviting me. And I enjoy talking about these things. You know, I've been interested and studied them for many years, as you mentioned. And so also interested in questions you all have. So, yeah. So what is it? I'm looking. I don't know. All I know is it's not too many days till Christmas. That's all I'm going to mention. And but happy holidays to everybody. But here's the thing today. We're going to talk about 3 major kinds of gastroparesis. And, you know, within each group, there are many types. So it's can be a confusing area. But mainly, we're going to talk about diabetes and gastroparesis, what we call idiopathic or cause unknown gastroparesis. And that third area, secondary, I'm mainly focus on surgery. You know, people who've had any kind of surgery on their stomachs can end up with a kind of an adverse outcome of gastroparesis that can be part of that surgery. So that's it. I'm going to spend maybe 10 minutes on each, and Mary Angela will keep me on time here or watch the time. But so diabetes, yes, we have type 1 diabetes. That's more of the insulin-dependent diabetes that starts often in younger people. And then there's type 2 diabetes, usually part of a metabolic syndrome that has to do with often obesity, overweightedness, hypertension, and type 2 diabetes often can be treated with diet and oral agents. And gee whiz, I see a lot more of these oral agents advertised on TV. So there's many different ways to get glucose under control. Because in the end, if you have sustained high glucoses, I like to think of it as glucose toxicity. You don't usually think of glucose toxicity because most of us, you know, we have enough insulin and our blood glucoses don't get very high, you know, maybe 120, 130 after a meal. But in diabetics, it can be very high for years, months, and years. And one thing we know is over time, you get to the complications of having glucose toxicity, high glucoses for many years. And it can be, of course, the eyes, it can retinopathy, it can be heart, you know, and ischemic heart disease, coronary artery disease, it can be the kidneys, and it can be peripheral neuropathy. And in some patients, not all, it becomes the GI tract. And constipation is very common in type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes, but constipation is common anyway. But a number of patients with type 1 diabetes, after we like to think about 8 to 10 to 12 years of not very well controlled diabetes, it can begin to get symptoms that are associated with gastroparesis. So the stomach is definitely one of the organs that can become affected by long-term high glucoses. And I do think the longer you know, the patient can control their glucoses as best they can, you know, keep the hemoglobin A1C down as best they can, all of these complications of diabetes, of sugar, of glucose, can be pushback. But in any case, we tend to think of type 1 diabetics having a course of at least 10 years that may get them into this situation. And, you know, at tertiary medical centers, half of the patients we see with type 1 diabetes, you know, will have gastroparesis. But that's really skewed, right? Because that's who comes to gastros in tertiary medical centers, that we just see more and more of those types of people. But anyway, we do think with time, there is a good number of patients with type 1 diabetes who develop the gastroparesis. You know, there's a few, maybe 5 or 10%, that's the first sign of a adverse event of high glucoses. It's not peripheral neuropathy, it's not retinopathy, it is the early satiety, nausea, vomiting, the GI symptoms. So we like people to be aware of that. It can be the first symptom. But, you know, once we have the symptoms and, you know, the physician gets to the diagnosis, it's the symptoms we've talked about for years and years, you know, that is the early satiety, the nausea, the fullness, there can be vomiting of undigested food. And the thing is that, you know, these symptoms are pretty nonspecific. So you always have to think about those postprandial symptoms of, like, what about the gallbladder? You know, the diabetic patients can have gallbladder disease that is not classic presentation. So this is something that should be one should be aware of. Could be a GERD symptoms as well. So in any case, these symptoms need to be worked up. And if there is gastroparesis, then we like to look at the stomach's electrical rhythm, because about a third of patients with gastroparesis, type 1, will actually have a normal rhythm. And so, you know, the others have these dysrhythmias. And we know that the number one cell line that is diminished in diabetes with gastroparesis are the pacemaker cells. And you all know now, when I say ICC, you know that I'm referring to the interstitial cells of Cajal, C-A-J-A-L, Cajal, the Spanish professor of anatomy, who described these cells about 100 years ago. And in any case, these cells are the pacemaker cells of the stomach. So if you don't have the pacemaker cells, they're dropping out, they're becoming depleted. This creates another subtype of gastroparesis. And we've talked in the past about how we kind of treat those differently. So this is kind of type 1 diabetes. And the thing is, if you wanted to switch to type 2 diabetes, and a type 2 diabetic who over time, as you know, it's still glucose toxicity. If you're not aware that the glucose is high, it takes a while to make the diagnosis, takes a while to get the glucose under control. We think the same thing, though, can happen, glucose toxicity. Of course, these patients can get, you know, peripheral neuropathies. And again, a certain percentage of them, and in my practice, you know, if I see a type 2 diabetic patient, there's a good chance they're going to have gastroparesis because they're seeing me for the nausea, vomiting that either isn't diagnosed or isn't well controlled. So, but the fact is, the symptoms are very much the same in the type 1 and the type 2 diabetic. And so, you know, once the diagnosis is made, we emphasize number one, doing the best you can to get the glucose under control. That's number one. If your glucoses are 300, 400, that's just going to be a problem, number one, from studies in even healthy people where one can increase the blood glucose by infusing glucose through the veins in a study. If in a healthy person, if the glucose level gets above 200 or 200 milligrams per deciliter, that will create a delay in emptying and even a dysrhythmia in healthy people. So you imagine that over and over and over, and this is why over time high glucoses can do damage and affect the way the GI tract works. So job one is to, you know, I always say just keep working with your diabetologist, keep working with your primary care doctor to do what you can to get that glucose under the best control that you can. Sometimes that leads, you know, all the way to you know, continuous glucose monitoring, insulin pumps, and there's many, many developments, excellent, you know, technological developments in the treatment of the high glucoses related to diabetes, and so that will help that long-term process that we've been talking about in terms of glucose toxicity. So we also, you know, use our usual prokinetic drugs, anti-nausea drugs. Like I said, if we have that gastroparesis with a great normal rhythm, we tend to look at pyloric therapies. We can do Botox and balloon dilation. These are probably good patients for the GPOM. If there's a dysrhythmia, we might go into the more prokinetic agents, maybe a gastric stimulator. This is kind of for both groups. I must say a couple things, though, for the type 2 diabetics. Of course, we want folks to lose weight, and the type 1 sometimes need to lose weight as well. Talk about our gastroparesis diet, which has three steps in it, you know, which is really for the diabetics can be quite aggravating because the diet that we recommend for the stomach that's weak and doesn't contract very well, and patients get nauseated after they eat, they feel excessively full after they eat, which is early satiety. Well, the diet we recommend is very, very different from the ADA diet. And so there are some patients, you know, they just aren't, this isn't talked about. So they continue to eat the ADA diet, which emphasizes salads. And salads are great because they fill you up and there aren't too many calories and there's very little sugar in a salad. And so that's really, diabetic patients really love the salads, but yet can imagine if you don't have a good rhythm, if your contractions of the stomach are weak, you know, salads and lettuce and cabbage and fresh carrots and these sorts of foods are very difficult for the stomach to handle, and they just don't mix and empty, so they sit there and they create these symptoms, you know, over and over. So that's why we coach this three-step diet, which, you know, if patients want to have more solid foods, we say, wow, well, let's not eat fried and fatty things, which slow the stomach. Let's not eat red meat, which can be fatty and a bit tough. Let's cut out the pulpy things and skins, which are hard to mix and empty. And so you can see the fresh salads are kind of like no-nos. And so and instead of that, you know, we suggest like a gummy bear vitamin. Wow, that's a lot to swallow, so to speak. And that's so anyway, the foods that are easier for the stomach are the starches, you know, like mashed potatoes, rice, chicken and fish in small, you know, cut up amounts are going to be much easier for those stomachs to mix and empty. So there's a real diet story there in trying to match the diet to the ability of the stomach to mix and empty. So those are some comments on diabetes, and I think there may be questions about that. We can wait on those. Maybe write them down. Because what about then is idiopathic gastroparesis? What does that mean? You know, and in our NIH groups, if we look at all people with gastroparesis, at least who are referred and get into our consortium registries, about a third are diabetics. The bigger group, we don't know how the patient got to gastroparesis. The idiopathic folks are mostly women. The same is true with the diabetes. These are strangely and you know, we don't know why these tend to be diseases that women have more than men. But fact is, about half of our patients with idiopathic gastroparesis remember like a febrile illness. They maybe had the flu, or they thought they had a GI bug. That's almost the most common thing to hear when you go back and say, well, you don't have diabetes. You didn't have an operation on your stomach. What did happen 3 to 6 months ago when this all began? So I really think a good number of folks have are in a post-viral, it's like a post-viral insult. And the insult was to the stomach, because we know there's post-viral, you know, meningitis. There's post-viral cardiomyopathies. I mean, the viruses, and now we have, of course, post-COVID, lots of problems after viral infections. And so, a group of the idiopathic folks, you know, have had a virus of some sort. And I think it'd be interesting, and maybe some people will comment or call in or write in to say, because what I'm curious about, because I haven't seen it yet, is in my own practice, I have not seen a surge in patients with nausea and vomiting or gastroparesis who say, gee, I had COVID, you know, 6 months ago or 3 months ago. Haven't seen those. And so I'm curious what you all are experiencing or hearing about from your friends in terms of that specific post-viral problem. we thought we might see a lot more. At least I thought we might see a lot more. Thank goodness we're not. I have been wondering about where do the idiopathic cases come from. I've had a few who say they were fine till they had food poisoning, which is kind of interesting, and they just never quite totally recovered. They got better, but did not totally recover. In terms of the postprandial nausea, early satiety, don't feel well. Another group is, after anesthetics, there's a small portion that can say, gee, that's when it began. And so, the thing is, we don't have a good, we can kind of guess about some of these, but you might say that the damage has been done, something happened, and now you find yourself with idiopathic gastroparesis. And at that point, folks with the idiopathic gastroparesis really look and sound a lot like the diabetics. Some people think that there's more pain with the idiopathic. There is more abdominal pain associated. Maybe the stomach doesn't distend as well. And at least one study showed the ICCs, those pacemaker cells, are more damaged in idiopathic gastroparesis. And so here again, we try to see, is this does this gastroparetic person have the normal rhythm, which we see in about 30%, or is it more of the dysrhythmia? So we get a little more subgrouping that way to organize our approach to treatment. But basically, except for that, the idiopathic patients don't have a glucose toxicity issue. We work with the diet, drugs, and, if diet and drugs don't help us, down the line, we will also think about the gastric stimulator, which is not as effective in idiopathic gastroparesis for the cases where, the symptoms are refractory to all these different medications and diet approaches, may go that direction. So idiopathic is the biggest group, and how do we, figure those folks out? And well, first of all, we want to get a diagnosis. We want to get a diagnosis that this is the symptom that the patient has. Some other things we check are like the thyroid, the cortisol level, even vitamin D. But, once again, I think there's you can't always find even a cause that goes along with the idiopathic cases. And I think in some patients, there can be, for whatever reason, a degeneration or a loss of these pacing cells from inflammation and just degeneration that we don't even understand. So these are all big areas to investigate going forward so we can do better. Third group, we're going to kind of talk about our other causes of gastroparesis. And here, I think, and this is kind of maybe somewhat obvious, and it's any kind of surgery that is done to the stomach can, be followed by a stomach that doesn't work like it did before the operation. And so the most common cause of post-surgical gastroparesis is the fundoplication. The so-called Nissen, Dr. Nissen kind of invented it 50 years ago. The Nissen fundoplication is the most common surgery done for gastroesophageal reflux disease or GERD or, heartburn that is really difficult to control. Patients eventually elect to have the surgical treatment, which is the Nissen fundoplication. That means fundoplication means the upper part of the stomach. The fundus is where the food first enters when we eat, and This is wrapped. It is basically pulled forward around the lower esophagus to make that lower esophageal sphincter a little firmer, a little stronger, and inhibit or reduce acid reflux. So that's the good news. Patients have reduced acid reflux. But in some patients, after that operation, they have a lot of nausea, they have early satiety, they're full, and we diagnose gastroparesis. And the thought is that sometime during that operation, inadvertently, because the surgeon is careful about looking around the esophagus, in that area where they're operating are the branches of the vagus nerve. The vagus nerve, which controls the stomach from the brain, the vagus nerve travels along the esophagus, and then it divides and innervates the stomach. And it's important for contractions, coordination. And in some patients, the vagus is injured, we think, during that operation. And so patients develop these new symptoms after the operation. And they're the symptoms associated with gastroparesis. So that's a group that we look for as a cause of gastroparesis. And sometimes those patients, the pylorus is a problem. The pylorus is too tight, and we can go back to pyloric therapies. Same thing, we look for the rhythm of the stomach to help us guide drug and pyloric therapies. And at that point, the treatment is somewhat the same, and I think we do pretty well with that kind of gastroparesis in terms of treatment, keeping symptoms under repair. A second one that I think is interesting but difficult is the hiatal hernia. Many of you have heard about hiatal hernias, you know, and often they're like tiny, they're like an inch in diameter. They're not really bothering anything. 2 inches not bothering much. But there are hiatal hernias that are 4 and 6 inches. And by the 4 or 6 inches, I mean 4 or 6 inches of the stomach, of that fundus I just mentioned, it has herniated into the chest. So that's a big hiatal hernia. And there's different kinds of hernias I won't get into, but you know, if it's a 4 or 6 inches of the stomach that's herniated up into the chest, doctors see that, well, in most thought, those should be repaired because they may twist, they may obstruct, and they can be a problem. So they get repaired by surgeons who basically pull that herniated stomach down where it should be. They kind of sew it back into its proper place. But at least in the patients I see, you know, during that process, the vagus nerve is injured. And although the stomach is in the right place now, it doesn't work as a neuromuscular organ, and those can be very difficult to actually treat. Again, we go through the same, you know, diet, promotility agents. Think about the pylorus to help the stomach work better when it receives food. So the repair of the large hiatal hernia, you know, can be a problem. Then I'll just mention, you know, anytime like parts of the stomach must be resected. From in the past, remember I talked about the more distal part of the stomach, the further down part of the stomach is the corpus and the antrum. The corpus, the antrum, pylorus. Those are the areas that have to do the mixing and emptying. They do the heavy lifting. That's really the mill and the emptier. Well, guess what? If you have a big ulcer or a cancer in those areas, they have to be oftentimes resected. So now you've, those are operations, those are classic operations. And if acid's involved, the surgeon does cut the vagus because we don't want acid. And then those areas that are unhealing, non-healing ulcers, scar tissue, may get a variety of operations that remove the corpus and the antrum, basically remove the mixing chamber. And then you have different, you know, ways to, you know, move food from the stomach to the small bowel through a surgically created opening. It's called an anastomosis. And you can imagine, you know, the stomach now is really, really at a disadvantage. It doesn't have its, doesn't have maybe the vagus innervation, doesn't have some parts of the stomach like the like the mixing chamber to really take care of mix and empty food normally, and a lot of diet and a lot of diet changes are sometimes needed. So again, we work through these same kinds of issues with getting the right diagnosis, helping with dietary advice and drugs where they might be helpful. So those are important problems. You know, surgeries are done for the right reason. Surgeries are done to try to help, but in some patients, yeah, certainly not all, in some patients, these gastric emptying, these neuromuscular problems after the surgeries become issues. You know, those are like direct hits on the stomach that are part of different surgeries. There are a couple other diseases we look for, and you know, some of the listeners might have them, but they may directly affect the stomach. One is scleroderma. It's a collagen vascular disease, and it's more associated with trouble swallowing and difficult to control heartburn. But it's kind of a scarring tissue, a very slow scarring tissue that in some patients affects the stomach. So when I see a patient with scleroderma, I do think about the stomach and is there a gastroparesis or a dysrhythmia or some part of the stomach that's contributing to symptoms in those patients. We've talked before about, you know, the autonomic nervous system and things like POTS or postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. You know, these are the autonomic control problems that mainly people think about blood pressure and heart rate kinds of problems, syncope. But we see a number of patients who also have problems with gastroparesis or dyspepsia, functional dyspepsia, that is normal gastric emptying, but all these symptoms. And so, you know, the stomach can get involved, I think, because of these higher levels of autonomic nervous system control are not quite right. And it can be hard, you know, maybe the person with POTS also had food poisoning, you know, and they're not related. So the same is with, you know, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, you know, the kind of joint mobility problem. And a certain number of these patients have gastroparesis, and but it's not quite clear, you know, is one causing the other? Certainly, they're related, but we don't know. And final thing I'll mention is, you know, narcotics. You know, when I see a patient who has to be on, you know, narcotics three times a day because of back pain and now their stomach isn't working, it's just a really, really, really bad problem, because I try to keep my patients, you know, far, far, far from any narcotics. But some people, is, you know, to have a life, they have to be on narcotics. But they cause dysrhythmias, they slow the stomach down, they slow the colon down, and everything I try to do to help the stomach is combated by, narcotics. So that's it's almost like an associated disease. It's just there, and but it just may have to set, you know, kind of parameters that, that's just almost the most difficult kind of GI motility problem to manage. Is basically it's impossible if the patient's taking a lot of narcotics. So you know, Mary Angela, that's kind of a three big groups we kind of covered, you know, from type 1 and type 2 diabetes, the diabetes types of injury to the stomach, all the way to gastroparesis, the idiopathics. You could think about post-viral or other injuries. Oftentimes people remember an acute nausea situation. They woke up from surgery with terrific nausea and vomiting, and they got better, but never quite all better. To a some kind of degenerative, you know, nerve problem, but the it's not nerves so much as those pacemaker cells get dinged and depleted, lead to stomach motility problems. And then we mentioned that third big group of surgeries. And a few miscellaneous things. So I think those are the comments I have at this point. I'm happy to take any questions that have come up.
Oh, thank you very much. That was a pretty thorough summary. Very good. I'm going to turn the program over to Melissa, and she's going to administrate the question and answer part. So I'm going to unmute everybody, and then Melissa.
Yes.
It's all yours.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to start with a question that was submitted through the registration forms because I think it's kind of interesting and really I haven't heard this addressed before. Can gastroparesis be present at birth?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, basically, it's not, as far as I know, except for one very interesting disease that is present at birth, and it's called, see if I can get it right, infantile hypertrophic pylorus syndrome. And it is pretty well described, but there are some infants that just keep vomiting. Even in the first week or so after birth, and the pediatricians are really into this, but basically you can feel this kind of I don't know, walnut sized thing in the upper abdomen, and that thing is the pylorus. Remember, the pylorus is, I mentioned it several times in my comments, and the pylorus is the sphincter. It's the sphincter that regulates gastric emptying, and we know in adults I kept mentioning these folks with the normal rhythm of 3 cycles per minute, which means they have normal amounts of ICCs, and so why can't they empty? And it's in these folks, even in adults, we know that the pylorus doesn't distend. It's like too strong, or it doesn't relax, or both. And the fact is, these little babies basically have that. And so they're born with this kind of hypertrophic, which means, you know, too strong, too big wad of pyloric sphincter, and it's too tight. And so the corpus antrum tries to, you know, send mother's milk or formula down past the pylorus, and it won't go. And so it's interesting when that's diagnosed, it's a surgical operation. The surgeon, pediatric surgeon, will basically cut that pylorus so it kind of opens up and relaxes. I have a way to sew it back, of course. And there you go. You're fixed. Babies do great after this. And I actually follow about 2 or 3 patients who had that operation as a kid. And, you know, like they said, growing up, they're never quite right. You know, their stomachs weren't ever quite right. And they I've even had some of them that with gastroparesis as an adult, still have some good rhythm. We might look at their pylorus now and then, but so there, that would be the at birth kind of gastroparesis, but it's related to the pylorus. I don't know of any other kinds, actually. That's the only one that I'm aware of.
That's interesting. I've never heard of that. Thank you for your answer. We have a question in the chat as well, and for some reason I can see it today, so that's good news.
Yay!
That's great.
Miss Joanne asks, can stimulant drugs cause damage to the vagus nerve just like narcotics can?
Well, I'm sorry, what kind of drugs?
Stimulant drugs.
Stimulant. You mean like what would be an example of a stimulant drug, like something for ADHD or like caffeine or...
She doesn't specify, but caffeine would be an interesting one to address since so many of us drink coffee.
Yeah, I think in general, these stimulants, at least if you're thinking about, you know, caffeine, Red Bull, things we ingest, no problem. No problem. In general, the stimulants like that sort are not known to increase or decrease gastric motility. Stimulants, what are some other stimulants? Caffeine is my main stimulant, so are there drugs people take that are considered stimulants? Are you talking about street drugs? How many of our listeners are on street drugs?
She has mentioned Adderall specifically.
Melissa?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
The second part of her question is, can you explain why some percent of patients gain weight versus losing weight with gastroparesis?
Yeah, that's a great question because it actually turns out from our NIH studies, it's like 50% of patients with gastroparesis are overweight. And there's another 10% that are like actually, you know, obese. And, you know, this contrasts with a small percentage, you know, that are, and maybe you know some of them, but they try so hard to get to 100 pounds. They struggle to get to 105 pounds. But that thank goodness is a minority. And so the majority of folks with gastroparesis are overweight, actually. And so this is a tough deal because I think then when patients go to the doctor and they've got nausea and vomiting, it often doesn't compute with the some physicians. Physicians have to be aware that when you have a stomach that doesn't work very well, it's often the starches that are the easiest to keep down. So the only, you know, I advise people all the time, you know, you got to give up your salad, and because we're using diet to, you know, diet to kind of match your stomach's, you know, physical strength. And if we know it's weak by the late gastric emptying test meal, well, that's why we recommend these other food groups, and they tend to be the ones that patients figure this out, their starches. And so I think that there tends to be more starch use, number one. Number two, I think when you're nauseated in particular, or you have discomfort, you don't feel like moving around too much. You don't feel like doing push-ups. You don't do sit-ups when you're nauseated. These symptoms are very debilitating, nausea in particular. There may be discomfort and pain. So I think activity shuts down. And That's why I always check thyroid, make sure it's not a hypothyroidism issue, and it rarely is in my practice. But so I think, you know, that's about as far as we've taken it. We do not understand. Nobody's asked, I don't think, the right question yet as to why this weight builds up on folks. But I'll tell you, I've had a few patients, and about that's my theory anyway. So be careful, you know, if you're gaining weight, you know, you look at the carbs, look at your activity. But I'll tell you, I've had some patients who are quite sick with their gastroparesis for many years. Their weight, you know, increased. They weren't happy about their symptoms or their weight. But for whatever reason, we do know some people's gastroparesis will heal and go away. This was one of those lucky people. And, you know, she came back one clinic visit, and it's like her weight had gone down 15 pounds. Well, you know, for most doctors, a weight loss of 15 pounds is quite troubling. It's concerning. Well, she was ecstatic. She said, I can't, my weight's coming down. And do you know why? And I said, no, why is it? Are you sicker? She said, no, I'm actually healthier. I can finally eat salads. I can finally get rid of the starches that it was all I was living on were starches, all I could keep down. As her stomach got better, she started eating healthier food. And as she ate healthier and felt well and wasn't getting nauseated on, let's say, a salad or those kinds of foods, she actually lost weight. So it's tricky business. Yeah, it's tricky. And those are some ideas for folks. You know, if you're trending up in weight, look at the starches, look at activity, but they're both kind of hard to do when you're improve upon if you have the symptoms associated with gastroparesis.
Absolutely. And we actually had a follow-up question related to that about, you know, how do you make your doctor take you seriously if you're not bone thin? How do you make friends and family understand? So I know that's a big issue in the community, and that's a helpful explanation. Thank you for that. Before I go to any more questions on the list, is there anyone attending today that has a question you would like to ask Dr. Cook?
Hi.
Hi, who am I speaking to?
Elaine. Elaine Greca.
Hi, Miss Elaine. Go ahead and ask your question.
It's like, which one should I pick? Because I've sent you some in the message. with the PACE cells, I had recently heard in the news that they had come out, I think it's a monoclonal antibody thing or stem cells. I don't know if those two things are the same, but it reversed this gentleman's type 1 diabetes. Do you happen to know if there's anything in the works that might stimulate growth of the PACE cells?
Yeah, it's a great question, because that's exactly where right now we think is the target. You know, there are inflammatory cells that come into where the ICCs live, and the more of these inflammatory cells are present, the more the ICCs die out. So the questions are, why is there inflammation in there? We don't know quite how to treat that yet. We need more science, if you will. But, you know, there's regenerative medicine centers in our country looking at different ways to produce these ICCs, smooth muscle cells, enteric neurons. But at this point, I'm not aware of anybody trying to grow ICCs and inject them into the stomach. I would love to do that someday. So you are onto it. I think that is the how do we get them back? How do we? What is the environment that is, if not depleting them, making them not work quite right? This is a key area that needs more research.
Can I add one more thing that might
yes.
help somebody else, but I don't know if it will or not. I was just given Emgality to that in those smooth muscle cells that you'd mentioned. I did a bunch of research before I took it because you got to inject yourself once a month. So if you get bad symptoms, you're stuck for a month to 120 days. So I really researched it, but it did mention the smooth cells. Do you happen to know if are those totally separate, or could I possibly gain something from the inflammation that's being reduced from that monoclonal antibody medication indirectly to support the
I think those pacemaker cells basically touch the smooth muscle cells, and then there are the enteric neurons. Those are the three cells that kind of work together to make a good contraction and a peristalsis. And so while the muscle looks okay on histology and electron microscopy, which is about as good as we can get, it could be that, you know, some of the inflammation that's affecting the ICCs, if that would be improved, then you might get better muscle coordination because of that. This would be speculation, of course. I'm not aware of, you know, that's getting kind of down into the cellular level, and but it's possible.
Fingers crossed it works for me that way. Thank you very much, and happy holidays.
Thanks for your questions.
Is there anyone else attending the call who would like to ask a question of Dr. Cook?
Hi.
Hi.
My name is it's Carrie.
Hi, Miss Carrie. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for your really interesting talk, Dr. Cook. My question is, you mentioned pyloric rhythm, kind of measuring pyloric rhythm and pyloric rhythm treatments. I've never come across this before, so I was just interested if you could elaborate a little bit more on these.
Yeah. So we've published a couple papers on this, but they're in scientific things, but journals. But here's the thing: the pylorus is that valve that helps regulate stomach emptying. And that valve, we look at an endoscopy. And of course, if there's obstruction there, the gastroenterologist is going to see it. You know, it's scarred tissue, rarely a cancer. So that's one cause of backup of food and gastroparesis. But when we look into the stomach with the scope, the pylorus can look okay, and we push our scope through it. There's always a little resistance because it's a valve, but in patients who have this normal rhythm I mentioned, that suggests that the corpus and the antrum are normal. So why would you not empty? And that's the clue that the pylorus is the problem. And now we have a device called an EndoFLIP where you can actually measure how distensible that pylorus is, and in many patients, almost everybody who has the normal rhythm in the stomach has a poorly distensible pylorus. So now you think of that's a problem of the outflow at the pylorus, and in those patients we will stretch the pylorus with a balloon to kind of loosen it up, or we put Botox around it to make it relax. And we found that it works best in those people who have the normal rhythm. Normal rhythm means you have enough ICCs. You know, you have enough ICCs in response to a test meal, which is water. We have people drink water till they're full. The stomach's full of water, and the stomach gets into a good rhythm. Suggests there's enough of those pacemaker cells. You see. And all of this, what I'm talking about, then directs us to the pylorus. And a lot of interest in that. It's somewhat new. Well, it's Now we keep rediscovering things we learned in the past, but the pylorus is a focus of interest amongst the scientists right now. But that's what we do to work on the pyloric part of gastric emptying. That make sense?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Dr. Cook, I know we're running a little short of time here, but I was wondering, we are actually seeing a big uptick of people joining the groups who are developing gastroparesis after having COVID. And, you know, I know the theory is that because it's a virus, that it's possible that it could cause the gastroparesis. But their question is, and the question from many who have post-viral gastroparesis, is can this, do you expect this to resolve over time? Can this be a very temporary situation if it's post-viral?
Yeah, another good question. Very nice. Yeah, the fact is, yes. The fact is, probably the vast majority of people who have nausea and don't feel like eating may have diarrhea, especially in this. This is pretty well described now. Yeah, you can get these GI symptoms in the acute phases of COVID. And then, but that's true also, you know, for a viral, just a regular virus that you might get during the winter, a flu-like gastrointestinal virus. But most people, immune system, you know, takes care of the virus, any damage done like to the ICCs or the neurons, whatever is might be damaged in that particular virus. I think it's the vast majority heal themselves, if you will. So I think if there are still symptoms 3 and 6 months later, now you may have a problem, you know, for the other symptoms. These are the long haulers. These are just can't get it. You can't get your sense of taste or smell back, or you can't get, I don't know, all your breathing comfort back. So I think, you know, it might take 3 or 6 months to really see where your stomach involvement ends, or is there still some problem? But I think,
thank
you know,
you,
you might hear more than I do. So it sounds like you are hearing from patients saying, and are they having the symptoms 3 and 6 months after the acute infection?
Well, I'm not sure we know that yet. We are. This is very recent, where they're starting to enter the groups and say that this is the speculated
yeah.
cause of the gastroparesis. So we're kind of following it to see what happens. But we've had
yeah.
a huge increase of people who have said that they've developed it after COVID. So kind of interesting. I appreciate your answer on that. And because we are almost at the end of the program, I will thank you and turn it back over to Ms. Mary Angela.
Thank you. I want to thank all of you for your questions to Dr. Cook. But before I continue, I just want to highlight one thing. You've heard us discuss this in our previous programs, but Dr. Cook has been working in conjunction with a girl named Laura, and they have been working on this wonderful book. And we've been waiting patiently for this book to be published, and it's about his three-step diet. And but it offers so much more. I mean, they have recipes in there. They have a lot of very beneficial and interesting and exciting material in there. So, Dr. Cook, do you have any idea when this is going to be coming out?
Well, thank you for mentioning it. Yeah, this. We're it's with the publisher and it's in the design phase, and we want it to be a beautiful book and a comforting book, actually, because Laura's very appreciative of how uncomfortable her sort of nauseated stomach was. So we found ways through diet, and I think diet and education, to find ways to nourish oneself plus keep the symptoms minimal. We touched on some of this. And so I'm hoping in, how about, shall I guess, February? I don't, but Mary Angela, thank you for mentioning that. Yeah, we hope we can get through this design phase here.
Yes, everybody thinks, you know, writing a book is a snap, but it is a long process. So yeah. We totally understand, yeah. But we will patiently or impatiently wait for that day when it will be available. And thank you, Dr. Cook, for your responses and your information. You're always, when you respond, and making it so easily understood, and you shine with your knowledge and understanding, your passion and compassion. And Melissa, thank you as always for your exceptional assistance with our program. And to all of you, you know the drill if you've been here before. As always, I speak from my heart to tell you that you're all my incredible heroes. Your willingness to learn, to share pieces of your lives with us, it's very humbling. And know that I pray each day, I think about you each day, whether I've met you or not, you are certainly in my heart, in my thoughts, and in my prayers. May God bless you all, and Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays to all of you. And let's hope the new year brings us good news and good things happening. With that, thank you again, Dr. Cook, and thank you again, Melissa, and thank all of you. God bless you all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye, everybody.